Hello, and welcome to Jilly Bowl, the podcast about that song you know nothing about. I'm Emily.
I'm Jamie.
Each week, we will break down a topic from Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire. We will take turns being the expert each week as we dive into these people, events, etc. Disclaimer, if you are already a history buff, this podcast isn't for you. If you're a sweet dum-dum just like us and want to know a little more, you're in the right place. This week's topic, Ayatollahs in Iran.
Okay. I'm really excited because I have not a clue about anything on this topic. What's an Ayatollah?
You're going to learn a lot of things. And you probably actually know more about this than you think you do.
Okay.
You're going to be surprised at the things you know about this. But there are so many other things.
I'll also be very embarrassed about the things that I don't know.
You will not be embarrassed. Okay. This has so much to do with foreign countries and different government structures and religions that there's so much going on. We just have to jump right in because there's so much. Okay. I want to start by talking a little bit about Muslims and Iran.
Okay.
So, first of all, there's two specific sects of Islam that we're going to be talking about today. The first one is Shia, also known as Shiite. And the Shia believe that after the Prophet Muhammad died, Prophet Muhammad died a long time ago, back in the year like 600.
Okay.
So the Shia believed that a man named Ali, who was a blood descendant, should have been the next caliph. That's like the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sunni peoples believe that a man by the name of Abu Bakr, who is a close follower of Muhammad, should be the next caliph. And in fact, Abu Bakr was chosen as the next caliph.
Okay.
There's so much more to it than that. There's so much more to the Shia and the Sunni,
We're
not here to cover that today. Just for the purpose of today's episode, that's what we're talking about.
Fair.
Yes. So, in the world, there are 1.5 billion Muslims. Of that 1.5 billion, 85% of them are Sunni.
Okay.
Yep. So, most Muslims on the planet are Sunni. In Iran, however, 90% of the people are Shia.
Oh.
And that last 10 or so percent are Sunni. So, who is Ayatollah Khomeini? He was a person, first of all. So, when we say Ayatollahs in Iran, we're not saying
Ayatollah
plural.
is in Iran. Ayatollahs.
Like plural.
As in like
there's many Ayatollahs. No, we're just talking about the
one. It's not an animal or.
No. No. There's not a bunch of Ayatollahs running around. Just this one dude. Just this dude. He was born September 24th, 1902.
Okay.
He has a kind of rough childhood here. When he was 5 months old, his father, Saeed, was murdered.
Oh.
So he was raised by his mother and his aunt. His mother died of cholera when he was 16. Ayatollah Khomeini. Tough. His family is Shia, and they claimed to be direct descendants of the Prophet Muhammad.
Oh.
I have no idea whether that's substantiated or not, but that's what his family believed. In 1962, Khomeini began to speak out against the Shah, so this is the person who's in power in Iran right now.
In 1902?
In 1962.
Oh, 1962. Yep. He was born in 1902.
Yes. So 1962. He's 60 years old. I just did a big jump because there's so much happening.
That makes sense. No, it's good.
So he, in 1962, is speaking out against the Shah, who is the head of the monarchy in Iran, because the Shah was using religious estates in this land reform program.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, he was taking away from space that was designated as religious. And also, the Shah was in favor of emancipating women. And Khomeini did not really believe in that. Yeah.
Oh!
So there's that.
Oh! okay.
Yeah, so,
I'm understanding a little more about you, yes. Ayatollah. I still feel bad about your mom and dad.
Right.
But
feel bad about your childhood, but this was part of...
Judgment.
This was based on his... Muslim faith.
Religion. Right.
And also, and don't worry, in a minute you're going to find out all about how the Shah is also himself not really a great person.
Okay. So,
there's not a lot of redeeming people in this story, but hang tight, because yes, there is at the end.
Ooh, yeah.
Okay, so Khomeini has spoken out against the Shah. It sparks some riots. Khomeini is arrested.
Okay.
And exiled from Iran.
Oof.
And he goes around to a bunch of different places. He ultimately ends up in France. We're going to come back to him later.
Okay,
so just put a pin in Ayatollah Khomeini for now.
There.
Okay, he's been exiled. So let's talk about what's happening in Iran and what's been going on, because things are heating up. In 1953,
okay,
we're backtracking a bit, the U.S. government
mm-hmm.
helped Iran overthrow the prime minister and bring Reza Shah Pahlavi to power. Why did the U.S. do this? If you have a guess,
know.
It's okay. It's oil.
Oh, well,
yeah. It's oil.
We need that.
We needed it.
Now.
So the U.S. government helped in this coup, basically. Reza Shah Pahlavi is basically known as the Shah, all right? He's just, that's what we call him, the Shah. He was a dictator, and he even increased his power once he was in position, appointing himself the absolute monarch instead of a constitutional monarch. Basically, I am in charge. I rule all of this.
I make the rules.
I'm in charge.
Not you. Me.
Me.
Yeah.
Just me, the Shah.
Okay.
He also had a secret police force that tortured people, and they were pretty brutal. They were called the Savak.
Oh.
And apparently the CIA helped train these people, maybe. I think.
Like, rumored to, or, like, pretty out there as a known fact?
I'd say, like, pretty substantiated.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that.
Oh.
Okay.
Thanks, CIA.
Yeah. The Shah was seen as very Western in his actions and in his thoughts. He kind of wanted to modernize Iran. Relations were very good between the Shah and the U.S., which angered a lot of the Iranian citizens. Okay.
Oh.
So, right, the U.S. government helped put this guy, this monarchy, into power.
Mm-hmm.
But the citizens, the people, did not want this.
Oh, they weren't about it.
They were not about this.
Okay.
President Carter once toasted the Shah on how beloved he was in his country by the people, which obviously made all of the anti-Shah people more angry.
Right.
Because they're like, no, we don't. We do not like this guy. He's doing all these things.
What are you talking about, Jimmy?
People felt like he wanted to Americanize Iran and basically just, like, wipe out their culture.
Right.
And wipe out the religion. And be just, like, this tool for America to use. And it made everybody really angry.
Which I could see.
Yeah. And not just necessarily Shia or Sunni, like, everybody was really not happy with this guy. Also, he had this secret police force that was going around beating people up.
Right.
So, just people...
Can't win people over with that.
No. And I don't even think he really wanted to be won over. He just wanted to be in power.
And he was.
Right. For a while.
Okay.
Things get crazy. So, there was a lot of unrest in Iran at this time. And there was a very religious right who supported the Ayatollah, who, remember, is still not in Iran. He has been exiled.
He's just about.
He's out there in France. And also the secular left. So everyone is mad at the Shah. Nobody's really, like, in love with him, necessarily.
Yeah.
In the late 1970s, protests led to a revolution that also involved Ayatollah Khomeini returning from exile. So he comes back to Iran.
And they let him in? Or he just, like, I'm here?
So, I think it's a combination of...
They needed him?
People wanted him there.
Right, right.
And as you'll see, things are about to go crazy for the Shah. So, we're actually mostly going to talk about the U.S. Embassy in Iran. We're not really going to talk about the Ayatollah so much. The topic of this episode is Ayatollahs in Iran, but it's him being there that caused some crazy stuff to happen.
I get it. Yeah.
Okay. So stick with me here, people. I know there's so much going on. Just, like, have another beer or something, and then it'll just make sense. Okay, so the U.S. Embassy in Tehran had been the site of many protests and demonstrations by people angered with the Shah and U.S. relations, right? People are pissed at him because he's, like, buddy-buddy with the U.S. and President Carter, and they feel like it's disrespectful.
Right.
An attack occurred on February 14th, 1979, where several
Valentine's Day.
I mean, I don't think it's Valentine's Day in Iran, but...
Well...
But it is the U.S. Embassy, so yes. There was an attack, and several people were killed or wounded.
Aww.
The American Embassy staff was then reduced from nearly 1,000 to just over 60 because of all of this unrest and protest and these attacks. It was really bad, so...
What was the first number?
1,000. So I don't know if necessarily, like, 1,000 people worked in that building, but people who were employed through the embassy.
Oh,
so they
cut
their staff by over 90%.
Wow.
In also in February of 1979, the Shah went on vacation, but really he was exiled. Like,
oh.
He and his family went on vacation, never to return to Iran.
Never?
Never came back. They never made it back. At least he didn't. I don't know about the rest of his family.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to come back either. Like,
no, everyone hate you. Everyone be hating you.
Yeah.
In October, so several months later, the Shah bounces around to different countries trying to seek asylum, basically, because he's a world leader who has been exiled by his country, okay? Ultimately, he's taken in by the U.S. to receive treatment because he's given the cancer diagnosis.
Oh.
After he's been exiled, he gets this diagnosis, and he's basically like, the only place I can get treatment is in the United States. You have to help me out. President Carter was a little bit apprehensive to let him in because, you know, he's this world leader who's been exiled. But Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller pressured Carter to say yes, and ultimately he did. So, the Shah ends up in New York to receive cancer treatment.
Lucky him. I mean, he had to feel so lucky.
I mean, he's pretty lucky given all of the bad stuff he's done.
Despite that he had cancer.
I mean, despite this really bad cancer diagnosis.
Very unlucky.
No, it's very bad. It's not good for him. So, let's jump back to Iran.
Okay.
People are pissed.
Yeah.
Because the Iranians saw President Carter giving asylum to the Shah as, like, a direct insult of, you've been, this Shah was disrespectful to our country, and now you're taking him in?
Right.
Like, are you going to try to put him back into power? Like, what are you up to? So then on November 4th, the embassy, the U.S. embassy, was attacked by approximately 3,000 Iranian student unions who were followers of Khomeini.
Uh-oh.
Some of whom were armed. Initially, the protesters planned on the occupation to be only symbolic and short-lived, kind of like a sit-in.
Okay.
But they were met with a force from guards at the embassy. So it was like, we've got weapons,
you've got weapons,
right? All things have escalated.
We better.
Right. Things get really ugly really fast.
Oh, shoot.
63 men and women were held at the U.S. Embassy. In addition, 3 more people were held at the Iranian Foreign Ministry. Hostages were blindfolded and shown before the media. It was really scary. President Carter and former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who had previously had really strong relations with Iran, were basically shut down. They were like, hey, you know, let's talk. And the people were like, nope, we're not talking to you.
No.
We're done with you. This caused the Iranian Prime Minister, Bazargan, to resign, but he demanded, with his resignation, if the hostages were to be released, that the U.S. extradite the Shah to Iran. So basically he's like, yeah, we'll let these hostages go. You give us our dictator back so we can put him on trial and kill him.
And get him gone. Like, get him good and dead.
Right. So
Do they know that he has cancer?
Oh, that's a great question.
I'm just
I think so. Because that was...
Not that that would change their mind. Like, oh, he has cancer. Like, he's going to die anyway. Like, okay. You just live out your short life.
That is a really good question. I don't know if it's public knowledge about this diagnosis or not. I think maybe.
Right. I mean, he's a big person and clearly had been in the news and talked about.
Right.
And at this point, it's I think that was part of the 80s.
Yeah, it's 79. So I think that's part of the reason why he wanted to be in the United States. That was part of his argument of, like, this is why I can't go to, like, France or Egypt or wherever else. Like, I have to come to the U.S. for this medical treatment. So I think it was public.
And they're like, we want him back and we'll give you your
hostages. Right. But so it's a difficult position because now Carter's faced with, like, okay, if I turn over this world leader, I'm basically turning him over to be executed. So he can't really do that either.
Yeah, that's, like, almost on him.
Yeah.
Jimmy, you're in a pickle.
Things do not go well for Jimmy Carter in this episode. Sorry to say.
Oh, Jimmy.
On November 12th, the acting foreign minister, Abu Hassan Bani Sadir, said that hostages would be released upon these three conditions, okay?
Okay.
If the U.S. stopped interfering in Iran, they were just get out of our business.
Okay.
Two, the Shah be returned.
Yep.
For trial and ultimately execution. And three, if all of the Shah's possessions were declared stolen items of Iran and returned. So basically, we want the Shah, we want his life, and we want all of his stuff.
Yeah, because I'm sure he had a ton
of stuff. I'm sure he had a ton of stuff. The U.S. then refused to purchase Iranian oil and put a freeze on Iranian assets in the U.S. So as an attempt to kind of, like, block them, to try to get them to release the hostages. This doesn't work.
Yeah.
On November 19th and 20th, 5 women and 8 African Americans were released as the captors claimed solidarity with oppressed minorities and the special place of women in Islam.
Yeah.
So basically they said, we know that these people are minorities and these people are oppressed, so we're not going to keep them as captors.
Yeah, we respect these people.
So we respect these 13 people. You're free.
Yeah, right.
So that was after about 2 weeks these people are released.
Oof.
One other hostage was later released on medical grounds. It was, I think, he was basically diagnosed with MS.
Oh.
When he was there, and so his medical situation got deteriorated, and he had to be sent out.
Right.
Oh. On November 19th, the U.S. filed a suit against Iran in the International Court of Justice, which I had not heard of. It sounds like a fake thing, but it's a real thing.
International Court of Justice.
Yes. It is the principal judicial organ of the U.N. So it's basically the court in the U.N.
Okay. Man, how do you get that job?
And I don't know. It's basically like...
You have to be a saint or like...
I don't even know.
You have to be so on the game. You don't drink alcohol, probably.
No.
You go to bed at 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know. Where do you live? You're basically like a judge of the world. Because this is like literally the U.S. It's one country filing a suit against another country.
Right.
Is what this... court does.
Right.
International Court of Justice.
Wow.
I want to know a lot more about that.
That would be interesting.
Yes. The court ruled in favor of the United States in May 1980. Nothing really becomes of this, though. Like, this doesn't lead to the hostages. It just doesn't make Iran release the hostages, though.
Oh, they're like, okay, yeah, cool. You think that, but we still have these
We're
people.
Still going to keep
what
these
you
people
gonna
hostage.
Do?
Mm-hmm. In the meantime... July of 1980, the Shah dies in Egypt after seeking permanent asylum there. So he leaves New York, he goes to Egypt, and he dies. So all of this has happened within the span of just over a year.
And the hostages.
The hostages are still in...
Oh, God.
In captive.
That sucks.
Yep. Let's talk about Canada. Did you see that coming?
Mm-mm.
I know. So, at this point, it was internationally agreed on that Iran was in the wrong for holding the hostages, and several other countries tried to intervene besides the United States. Other countries tried to, you know, like diplomats and everything tried to...
Fair enough.
Yeah. You know, negotiate things, but this didn't work out. January 28th, 1980, Canadian diplomats helped 6 American diplomats escape. Does it sound like a movie to you?
Is it a movie?
It's the movie Argo.
Oh!
It's Argo, yes.
Okay.
Yes, so if you've seen the movie Argo, Ben Affleck is acting and he directs it.
I Don't Breathe during that
movie.
No,
oh, it's so stressful.
Oh, it's so stressful.
So that's this.
Gotcha!
Okay, so that's this hostage crisis that's
okay.
happening. Okay. Oh. So what had happened was...
I want to watch that movie again.
I need to watch it again now after doing all this research. So what had happened was 6 American diplomats escaped the embassy but ended up at the Canadian diplomats' house and residence, okay?
Okay.
So they were unaccounted for. But if they were found out about it all, they would have come and captured them, right? Because there were so many protesters and captors and what have you.
Right.
So that's what the movie Argo is all about. There's a big... Okay, so the film is really criticized. I don't want to take too much time talking about the film, but we have to just talk about a couple things. One big discrepancy is that in the movie, the Canadian ambassador, Ken Taylor, is shown at one point threatening to close down the embassy due to the risk of keeping the Americans there. But in reality, Taylor was actually the one who pretty much orchestrated the whole rescue.
Oh.
So even though Ben Affleck's character, Mendez, who is a real person, was involved, he was kind of just one part of this larger effort. And the Canadian ambassador was really the one who was
behind
this whole thing.
Okay.
President Carter was actually quoted saying after this whole thing, quote, the main hero, in my opinion, was Ken Taylor.
Okay. So
Ben Affleck said... Because I know
tell
you're
me,
like,
Benny.
please tell me what Ben Affleck thinks. He said, because we say it's based on a true story rather than this is a true story, okay. We're allowed to take some dramatic license. Yeah. There's a spirit of truth. So, I mean, I guess so. It's
okay.
Based on a true story, but I mean, I do think it's kind of a major fact that...
You got the wrong guy.
The guy who's being given a lot of the credit, but... Don't worry, we're going to find out about another person who's super cool.
Cool.
With that whole Canadian caper is what it is actually referred to, the Canadian caper.
Canadian caper.
Yes.
Alliteration for the win.
So much alliteration. This hostage crisis is often referred to as the 444-day crisis because that is how long it lasted. 444 days.
Can you... Just imagine being a hostage for that long.
No, I cannot.
In Iran.
No, I absolutely cannot. I can't even wrap my head around it.
Uh-uh.
Things are about to get really bad here, folks, so sorry.
Okay.
I'm real sorry.
Let me take a sip of
some wine. Everyone. Everybody take a drink.
I'm ready.
Right, so conditions basically go from bad to worse for the hostages.
Shoot.
There's 52 hostages remaining, right? Because we had the 13 leave, and then the
six.
Guy, and then the Canadians. Okay, so there's 52 hostages in the embassy. But after a failed rescue mission from the United States, they were spread around different locations in Tehran to make a rescue almost impossible. So no longer were they all held together. They were separated. So it was just like...
What if you had really made a friend or...
Right. Or what if you were...
Married.
Like, yeah, but I guess they sent the wives... All the women were sent
away.
Oh, so it
was men.
It was all men at this point. Still, not great to be... This was bad. Iranian propaganda claimed that the hostages were being well taken care of and that they were guests. This was super duper not true. Hostages were subject to having their hands bound for days on end, being paraded in front of angry crowds, being beaten, having items stolen, and being placed in solitary confinement. So... It's torture, not in the sense of, like, extreme physical torture, but it is very psychological, and...
Yeah.
It's really terrible. This is the worst of the abuse I have to talk about. On February 5th, 1980, guards wearing black ski masks woke up the captors in the middle of the night, blindfolded them, and had them undress and then cocked weapons only to eject the ammunition. So they basically tricked them into thinking they were going to be executed.
Right.
And then they were like, nope, it was a joke.
Just kidding.
Just
go back to your room.
Yep. So just like
without dinner.
Severe psychological torture. There's even more, but I'm not going to go into all of it because it's just bad. The U.S. Okay, so earlier I had mentioned there was a failed rescue mission. Ugh. If you thought things were bad for Jimmy Carter before.
Yeah, he didn't succeed.
Just hold on to your butt because they're not good. Jimmy Carter. Things go bad. The U.S. started seeking a military option after being unable to negotiate with anybody. On April 24th, 1980, a military attempt with the code name of Eagle Claw, because America, was made, but it failed due to some bad weather and also malfunctions in two of the eight helicopters. And one helicopter collided with a support craft and eight Marines were killed. Disaster. All around. Carter looks an idiot. It's so bad. It's like, everyone's like, are you kidding me?
Have you flown a plane before?
Right? Well, and it's like, how, like, this was your plan. Like, this is the best
we
can do.
You didn't think this through.
And it's also April.
Did you come with this last night when you were drunk?
Right. And then, like, it's like, guys, what happened? And it's terrible. I mean, people died in this failed, and it was like, not even, they didn't even make it there. Just such terrible. Everyone looks bad. It internationally just not good. And then obviously American citizens are not thrilled with Carter either.
No.
The U.S. does convince some close ally countries to enforce an embargo against Iran, but it wasn't strong enough. Or I'm sorry, but it wasn't enough to weaken Iran. So basically, the U.S. says, "Hey guys, stop doing trade with Iran, and we're gonna try to kind of like." Choke them up on their trade and their financially, like they're not going to be able to survive without trade from everybody. And ultimately, it does damage Iran, but not enough to like make them immediately release the hostages. Right. Okay, so let's talk solution.
Okay, what do they do? How do we solve this? How did we get to 444?
We didn't solve this. Don't worry, we didn't. August 1980, Iran installs a new government. Because now the Ayatollah is in charge. He is the supreme leader. So there is no more monarchy. Yes, Ayatollah Khomeini is in Iran. Here we go.
Ayatollah's
in Iran. He is the supreme leader. So it is no longer a monarchy as it was before. It is now a religious state. This is not a democracy. He has created a new government along with others. It's not just him alone. Obviously with
but
other
he
people.
Has people and he's right. been scheming and planning
right
he's
so
prepared.
He's in power now.
Yeah.
And on September 22nd, 1980, Iraq invades Iran over a border dispute, which is bad for Iran, but the Americans see it as like, all right, now they're going to be even weaker because of this. The Iranian prime minister, whose name is Mohammad Ali Rajai, visited the UN on November 1980, but several leaders told him they're not going to support him with this Iraq conflict while they have American hostages.
Right.
Like, look, it's someone's invading you, but we can't help you out. You've got American people.
Innocent hostages.
Right. After, and at this point, it has been well over a year, like, that this has been going on. Ultimately, Algerian diplomats were the middlemen for negotiations from late 1980 to early 1981, focusing mostly on these frozen Iranian assets and lifting the trade embargoes. And because, obviously, like, the Shah is dead, so that was, like, one of the big things that they wanted him back, but he's dead, so it doesn't matter.
Right, like, what are you going to do about it now? Like, you want his corpse?
Yeah, like, who are you going to put on trial?
Right.
That monarchy
is... He's super dead.
He's super dead. It's done. An agreement is finally made after the hostages were released January 20th, 1981, minutes after Reagan's inauguration.
Oh.
Yes. So, in 1980, it was an election year, and Reagan is just blasting Carter on this whole thing. He's like, he hasn't done anything in months. There's nothing, like, what is he going to do? Look, he's not doing anything. And I think it helped bolstered Reagan's campaign.
For sure.
And helped get him elected, really. Although Reagan didn't really, I don't think, have anything to do with these negotiations. Because he wasn't even president yet.
No. And, yeah, just barely.
He literally, like.
Well, he would have been elected, but then he would have been not elected. Inaugurated till
no.
When that happened.
Yes.
But he would not have any opinion.
No.
He got a tour of the house and then...
No. It was really other countries that helped solve this negotiation problem.
Thanks, other countries.
Thanks, Canada. This whole crisis really impacted U.S.-Iran relations for years, and it's still a point of contention.
Yeah.
Obviously, because it was 1981 that they were released. It's not that long ago.
No.
Okay, so finally, guys, where are those women at?
Where are they at?
Where are those women at?
I miss them.
I have two really important women to tell you about. First one is Mary Catherine O'Flaherty. She was a beautiful Canadian woman from Newfoundland, and she worked at the Canadian embassy during the hostage crisis.
Oh.
She was in charge of communications, and she managed some top-secret messages to and from Tehran and Ottawa. So she's in Tehran. Like, she's in this.
Oh.
She was in the Canadian diplomat's house where the six American people were hiding.
Okay. So she was, like, on the ground helping.
She is... she would code messages and decipher messages. Her final message from Tehran back to Ottawa before the escape was, "See you later, exfiltrator," because the mission was known as the exfiltration.
Yes.
Because they were like, we out.
See you later, exfiltrator.
See you later, exfiltrator.
Gonna use that one.
I know, right? And this woman was fascinating. After this whole event, she later went on to work in Moscow and New York and Islamabad. She worked all over the world. Ooh. Just like this cool lady. And she actually lived well into her 90s.
Jeez.
Just a cool lady. One other woman I want to tell you about is a gal named Randy Goodman. She has a master's degree from Boston University, and she's a photojournalist. Hey. At the age of 24...
Young.
She traveled to Iran just 3 months into the hostage crisis, and she took photographs of mostly women.
Cool.
She visited, like I said, in 1980, and then she returned in 2015, and she ended up having an exhibit at Harvard titled Iran Women Only, and the showcase was all about the changes that she saw. The photos she took in 1980 were black and white, and the photos she took in 2015 were in color. Her most famous photograph from this whole collection is a photo from 2015 of a woman in a taxi cab in the driver's seat. It's her taxi, and it's bright green, and the side it says women's taxi, and so it's kind of showing how women in Iran in 2015 could be business owners, and they could be
they're doing it
yeah. And it's a really interesting photo. We'll put it up on our Instagram and our Facebook and everything. So I just thought that was really fascinating how she went as a 24-year-old, like, so young, to go be a photojournalist in Iran during this crazy, like, there's a hostage crisis going on of Americans. And you're like, yeah, let me go there and take pictures.
My life is, I got this.
Yeah, like, sure.
I'm here to help.
Ain't no thing.
I'm confident. I guess, so. I mean, when you are younger, you are confident.
Yeah. So I listened to an interview with her, and it was really fascinating. Cool. So we'll put up some of her pictures. They're beautiful. So that's Ayatollahs in Iran, friends. So much happened there.
A lot. But a lot
going on.
It makes sense. I followed you.
Okay, good. When it comes to Ayatollah, I mean, they did start some fires. He started some fires.
There were many fires.
There were many fires. Did he start the fire? I don't know.
There are a lot of people starting fires. And, like, not putting a fire out.
No.
Just, everyone, like, stoking the fire.
Everyone was lighting fires everywhere.
Yeah. And not maybe in the best way.
No. Mm-mm.
Fire was involved with Ayatollah.
Definitely. But he was not fire, I would say. All I have to say is, see you later, exfiltrator.
In a while.
I've been Emily.
I've been Jamie.
Bye.
Bye-bye.